I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 22nd, 2024. We do have a quorum. First order of business will be moving the minutes of February 20th. Representative Finke, would you like to move the minutes of February 20th, 2024? All right. Representative Finke moves the minutes. All those in any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First on the list today, Vice Chair Frazier. You ready?
I am. I will be by the time I get up to
that. Right? Yep. So Representative Frazier, the first order, first bill we've got up is House File 3309, a scintillating topic.
Scintillating.
Yeah.
Set me up, Chair.
So I will move that House File 3309 be placed on the General Register. I know we've got an amendment and then a quick oral amendment. So first up, we Representative or Vice Chair Frazier, would you like to move the A24-0192 amendment?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
All right. And then I understand you have an oral amendment to the A240192. Can you tell us what that oral amendment is?
We caught a staff caught a drafting error in the original amendment. This fixes that drafting error. And then if I can just tell you about the amendment as a whole. The amendment as a whole, we've adapted essentially similar language that has been adopted in Washington and Kentucky. And the reason we've done this is because, as I'll talk about later, Minnesota's statute, original statute on this, was deemed unconstitutional. And so now that we have a statute that is that we're proposing today, this statute has been in place in Washington and Kentucky. And in Washington and in Kentucky, particularly in Washington, there was a case where this was found constitutional and it had the same language. So we're just lining up with what we've seen it work.
Got it. And do you want to tell us what the oral amendment is?
Staff.
Ms. Davis.
Chair and members, on page 2, line 3 of the amendment, the A24-0192, on page 2 at line 3, at the end of that sentence, it says under paragraph A, and that should read under paragraph C. So page 2, line 3, we would delete parentheses A and insert parentheses C.
All right. Vice Chair Frazier is nodding. That is his oral amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Amendment passes. And then now we've got the underlying amendment, the A24-0192, as orally amended. In front of us, all those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Now we got the bill in the shape that it needs to be in. Vice Chair Frazier, please tell us about the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again to our wonderful staff for catching that drafting error. Really appreciate it. House File 3309 addresses lawsuits known as SLAPP or a strategic lawsuit against public participation. This is a notorious type of frivolous litigation that, since the 1980s, powerful entities and individuals have used as a tool to stifle dissent and harass critics, suppressing their First Amendment rights. These lawsuits typically make some type of defamation, invasion of privacy, or a nuisance claim, but their real purpose is to force the defendant to waste large sums of money to defend themselves. In that sense, the outcome of the lawsuit is irrelevant to the plaintiff. Bankrupting a critic of theirs, potentially into silence, is the real victory. So more than half of the states in the U.S. have implemented anti-SLAPP statutes, including Minnesota, which enacted our anti-SLAPP legislation in 1994. So why are we here? Well, our anti-SLAPP legislation was found unconstitutional in 2017, and this bill will replace that law. The bill I offer today has been developed by a Uniform Law Commission known as the Uniform Public Expression Act, or UPEPA, which has been introduced in at least 7 states, now 8th with this bill, and enacted in 6 more: Hawaii, Kentucky, New Jersey, Oregon, Utah, and Washington. The UPEPA is meant to standardize anti-SLAPP regulations from state to state. And with that, Chair, I will yield to my two expert witnesses who do find this very scintillating. And it's been great working with them, Commissioner Harriet Lansing and Commissioner Michelle Timmons from the Uniform Law Commission.
Yeah, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Michelle Timmons, former reviser of statutes, although I've been retired more than seven years already, which hardly seems possible. And I'm a uniform law commissioner. I've been doing that now for 25 years, I think. I thought I would start, since this is the first time we're appearing in front of the committee this year, I thought I would start with just saying a few words very briefly about the Uniform Law Commission and the work that it does to kind of set the stage. The Uniform Law Commission is a very old organization. It was established in 1892. And the purpose of it is really to come up with legislation that can be enacted in all 50 states. And so because of that main goal, one of the key issues is uniformity, trying to find topics where it's important to have uniformity between the states in order to make everything work well. And so the organization has between 300 and 400 attorneys, all of whom are appointed by their states and all of whom are volunteers who serve without any compensation. And the process of picking topics is really studying what needs to be done in the states. And oftentimes there is a study committee that works for about a year, has uniform law commissioners, a reporter who is usually a professor, somebody with expertise in the field. And then another important thing is that we try to identify stakeholders, observers who have an interest in that particular topic. And they are very much allowed to participate, make suggestions, participate in the conversation all along the way. And then if the topic is deemed appropriate for a drafting committee, that happens next. Again, there's a group of commissioners, a reporter, stakeholders, and these meetings are all open to the public. And once the drafting committee has a first draft, it goes for a first reading in front of the whole body, the 300 or 400 attorneys, at the annual meeting. And so the annual meeting is not like any other annual meeting of an organization you've probably been to. It's a lot more like a legislative session. So literally, the committee members and the reporter would sit up at the dais, much as you are here at the committee, and read the act word for word, line by line. And then if you can imagine a room full of 300 or 400 attorneys and about, you know, 4 to 6 microphones.
Yikes.
The attorneys get up and make suggestions for amendments, discuss the policy behind the law, et cetera. And so after the first reading, if the act gets through the first reading, then we wait another year, polish up the act some more, and go for a second reading, whereupon it gets read word for word, line by line again. And then at the end, when the act is all as polished up as we can make it, it goes for a vote of the states. And if approved by a majority, it will be a uniform act. And then typically after that, the Bar Association will look at the act further as an additional process. But and as Representative Fraser said, this was deemed an important topic because of the fact that while many states had this type of anti-SLAPP legislation, a number of them, including ours, had been declared unconstitutional. So it seemed to be a really good topic to study and try to come up with an act that will be deemed constitutional. And that's what I believe we've done and have before you today. And if I could now turn it over to Judge Lansing to talk more about the substance.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. My name is Harriet Lansing. I'm a retired Minnesota Court of Appeals judge, and I am a Minnesota Uniform Law Commissioner, a life member. And I'm here just to give you a brief background on the history and the purpose of House File 3309. This act, which is referred to as the Uniform Public Expression Protection Act, is essential, or we try to create some short-term references. And so this one is UPEPA, which is a lot easier to remember than some of our other short titles. But it's as Vice Chair Frazier said, this act is essentially to replace Minnesota statutes 55401 through 55406. Those statutes, which were enacted in 1994, which is about 26 years ago, were determined to be unconstitutional in 2017, not because of their purpose, but because of the procedure. Those provisions were not part of a Uniform Law Act, as has been stated, but were drafted and advanced in an unrelated initiative to protect public expression on issues of public concern. And then, Commissioner Timmons said, then the Uniform Law Commission became involved when these laws encountered constitutional challenges, and we began a process to draft a uniform law that would achieve the same goals but not have the procedural flaws that resulted in determinations of unconstitutionality. The goal that UPEPA seeks to achieve, as has been stated, is to provide a remedy that will prevent lawsuits aimed at intimidating people who are exercising their First Amendment rights on matters of public concern. And the process by which we seek to do it is by providing expedited procedures that will allow for early dismissal of meritless claims and will keep these meritless claims from subjecting defendants to the burdens of harassment, the high costs of extended attorney's fees, and the additional costs of needless discovery demands. My colleague and co-commissioner and former Minnesota Reviser of Statutes will comment more specifically on the procedural aspects of UPEPA. But for now, I just want to take a few minutes to tell you why I think that the ULC UPEPA is important and why I think it is worthy of enactment. Let me start with one of the background information sheets that is in your information packets. It's an open letter in support of UPEPA from 28 organizations that ranges from the American Society of Journalists and Authors to the American Civil Liberties Union to the International Association of Better Business Bureaus, and I think it even includes the comic book Legal Defense Fund. So, as they say in their introductions, they represent an array of views across a wide spectrum, but they strongly agree in their support of UPEPA, and they give six reasons why. First, they strongly believe that protection of public expression on issues of public concern is important. Second, because the Act serves the purpose of minimizing litigation costs by allowing entities to expedite the dismissal of expensive, burdensome, and meritless lawsuits, which also I say, based on my professional history, I particularly approve of. It helps court calendars. Third, because UPEPA's procedures require the plaintiffs to show that they have a legitimate case early in the litigation. Fourth, there is a cautionary protection for an immediate appeal. And fifth, there is a provision for costs and attorney's fees. And sixth, it underscores that interpretation of the Act that aims at protecting the freedom of speech and of the press and other constitutional protections. And as it relates specifically to Minnesota, I would add two more reasons that this Act is worthy of passing. as was pointed out by Representative Frazier and Vice Chair Frazier, Minnesota statutes 554.01 through 554.06, as they currently read, are unenforceable, having been found to be unconstitutional in 2017 in Leindecker versus Asian Women. I believe it is very important to make our laws as clear, as accurate, and as enforceable as they can be. And finally, in addition to the 28 signatories on the open letter in support of the Act, Minnesota entities have also expressed their support of the Act, including the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Newspaper Association, which has strongly endorsed it, and the Minnesota Association of Justice, which endorsed it, and Professor Jane Kirtley, who is the Silha Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota, a very highly regarded and often quoted national authority on media ethics and law. She has commented favorably in several capacities that these anti-SLAPP or UPEPA-type protections are a huge help in protecting defendants from frivolous lawsuits where there is no legal merit. So for these reasons, I believe that UPEPA is an important act and that it is worthy of your support. And I will now turn the microphone over to my colleague, Michelle Timmons.
Yeah, and I'll just remind you, we've got like five other bills today.
Yes.
So, and we do have a couple member questions as well. So go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I'll keep this very brief. I just wanted to say that a shorthand way that Commissioner Judge Lansing described this act is as a summary judgment provision on steroids that's designed to get rid of frivolous lawsuits and clear the clogged courts. And so one of the really great things about this act, as I was reading through it with my reviser background, I couldn't always draft the best statutory language, but I kind of know clear drafting when I see it, having reviewed a lot of things. And the procedural provisions on pages 2 through 4 of the Act are really very good and clear, providing first for a special motion for expedited relief, then very clear provisions about a stay, and clear provisions and timelines regarding the hearing, the proof needed, the fact that the dismissal of the cause of action can be in whole or in part, and clear timelines for the ruling and the rights for an appeal. And so I think that will also very much help with cleaning up our Minnesota statute and providing a constitutional and clearly written provision.
All right, thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, moving on to member discussion, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill. Thank you to the work of the Uniform Law Commission on this and for all of you proactively reaching out to me to talk about this bill. It's an important bill, and even emailing with me last night about this amendment. I did want to ask a question, kind of a follow-up question to our discussion yesterday about this amendment. It adds a bunch of exceptions that aren't in the Uniform Law Commission's draft of UPEPA. And aligns it more with the Washington statute that was interpreted in Job versus Con. And so my question is, if you could speak to some of these additional exceptions that are here, is there any reason to be concerned about them? How are they generated, et cetera? If you could speak to that one.
Whoever wants to take that one.
Yes, Representative Niska, Madam Chair and members. Well, first of all, these amendments were proposed by a group of trial lawyers in both Washington State and Kentucky. And they were essential in those two states for enactment. So the second point I would make is that in Washington State, which was very similar to Minnesota in that their original anti-SLAPP statute had been declared unconstitutional. After they adopted the amendment and enacted the new uniform statute with these clarifying exceptions, what happened is there was litigation, and Washington State Appellate Court did find that the statute was constitutional. And I believe Commissioner Lansing let me know there was a second appellate decision just this morning that she discovered that similarly said, yes, this is constitutional. So when Judge Lansing and I were discussing this amendment with Vice Chair Fraser and saying, should we propose this here in Minnesota or not, our thinking was, well, you know, it might help and it can't hurt. And we have this decision, now two decisions from Washington State, that have said this act is constitutional as written. That really put Minnesota in the best position to repeal our old statute and replace it with one that is constitutional. The third point I would make is that the Uniform Law Commission, of course, looked at the proposed amendment when Washington and Kentucky did it and said, you know, essentially what I just said, it does no harm to the act. And so if you enact the amendment, which clarifies exactly, you know, what the exceptions are, and then says, oh, but there are some things dealing with the media and those who are in the business of public expression that we need to protect. It does no harm to the original act, and we will deem it to still be uniform within the context of the Uniform Law Commission. So I don't know if you had anything more to add.
Briefly, please.
Yes, very briefly, Chair. One is that the litigation that has come out of the very limited thing has to do with scope. And so the intent of this was to be as specific as possible about the scope of the act. And that's its purpose.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Niska?
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Just some follow-up comments. Thank you for hearing this bill. It's a really important bill, and I think it really goes to some of the core functions of this committee in a couple of different ways. Obviously, sometimes I feel like a broken record talking about how important it is to consider the procedure in the different civil procedure and in the different ways that even frivolous lawsuits or lawsuits where a party has the right legal case can still lose because of the way procedure is set up. And this does a really good job, I think, of correcting that in a really, really, really important area of the law that goes, again, to another core part of our what this committee should be concerned about, which is the constitutional rights of everyone to freely speak on matters of public concern. That's why there's been bipartisan national commitment to passing anti-SLAPP laws. When we passed one, the one that was struck down in Leyendecker, it was a bipartisan bill, but it was procedurally flawed because it was asking judges to do essentially fact-finding at an earlier stage in the litigation that ran into problems with the jury trial right in Minnesota. This is like you said, like the commissioner said, very carefully crafted to bring in the established Rule 12 and Rule 56, you know, motion to dismiss and motion to, for summary judgment procedural mechanisms in a way that does a better job of protecting that the First Amendment rights without without violating the jury trial rights, just like a Rule 12 motion and a Rule 56 motion and at any other context is consistent with the jury trial right. There's a provision in here which I think is important and great that, that we're directing the courts to presume and that the law should be interpreted to the fullest extent possible to protect First Amendment rights and that it should be interpreted uniformly. So I do appreciate the amendments to bring this in line with the Washington statute that has been interpreted and upheld. It's carefully drafted by the Uniform Law Commission. And I really appreciate the work that was done. I'm happy to support this bill. It's a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we get to talk about the Constitution more than any other committee, but this is also, I suspect, the kind of bill most non-attorneys, why they don't want to be on this committee. I thank you for the work that went into this and for bringing this forward. Closing comments, Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just note none of the non-attorneys fell asleep during this conversation.
Good job. You know, good job, guys.
I appreciate that.
As you can tell.
Right, so I was like, I don't think there's any more to be said. This is an important bill to bring things back into to meet constitutional muster. Representative Miska, thank you for your support on this bill, and I hope everyone votes for it.
Yeah, I will renew my motion to move that House File 3309 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Next up, Chair Mueller. Chair Mueller, would you like to move to recommend that House File 3509 be placed on the General Register?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my motion, and there will not be any Taylor Swift lyrics in the presentation of this bill today.
Not on purpose, anyway. Chair Mueller, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this is an issue that I have been working on for over a decade in my other job as a prosecutor, and it has to do with protecting privileges and privacy of victim survivors of crime. The privilege statutes are in a separate chapter, Chapter 595. They're not specific to criminal or civil law, so these are privileges that apply in all kinds of court circumstances. And I think most people on this committee are probably familiar with the attorney-client privilege or the privilege you have as a patient for your mental health records or your medical records. In statute, we also have privileges for the conversations between a sexual assault advocate and victim survivors of sexual assault, and a privilege for domestic violence victim survivors and their advocates. These communications, whether it's attorney-client or the kind of communication you'd have with your doctor or as a victim to these community-based advocates, are meant to protect information because we want people to fully be able to communicate whatever issues they're having with those people for whom they're having that conversation. I did have a testifier, and she was unable to come because she has court today, and I'm just going to read a portion of what she would have said had she been here. Her name is Raina Alexander, and she represents a lot of the domestic violence and sexual assault community-based programs in the state through her job at Standpoint. She says, domestic violence is an underreported crime, and among the many reasons victims give for not reporting or seeking help is the loss of anonymity and privacy that comes with engaging in the criminal justice system. Access to confidential advocacy services, crisis support, and ongoing counseling is critical to the health, recovery, and safety of domestic violence victims. Working with an advocate can provide a safe, confidential, and non-judgmental opportunity for a victim of domestic violence to consider all available options while addressing any pressing needs, including crisis support and access to services in responding to the trauma they have experienced. In 2022, a Minnesota Supreme Court decision, the sexual assault counselor privilege was found to be an absolute privilege. However, the domestic abuse advocate privilege was found to have broad exceptions, including that the court could order disclosure of the advocate's records and conversations. This means that if a domestic violence victim seeks support from a domestic abuse advocate, their conversations are not strictly privileged. The court could order disclosure. considering between 40 and 45% of women in abusive relationships will also be sexually assaulted during the course of the relationship. If the same domestic violence victim was to speak to the sexual assault counselor, that conversation would be strictly privileged. In addition, because of the lack of funding, many programs service both victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, which means a victim could tell their story to one advocate, and the part of their story about sexual violence would be absolutely privileged, and the part about domestic violence would not. This leaves victim survivors and domestic violence advocates unclear about whether their conversations are absolutely privileged. Victim survivors often express feeling re-victimized by the system when their records from a domestic violence program are sought. And so that really, members, really lays out sort of the discrepancy that we have in the law right now with some of these privileges like sexual assault privilege, and then this one which allows for a court to basically invade the privilege that a victim has with an advocate. I do know that there is a letter of opposition in your packet today from MacDill. I believe they're going to testify, and I think there is a fundamental misunderstanding in that letter. Clearly, if the state has information, if this was somebody working for the state, the prosecutor is obligated to disclose that information, either under the Brady decision from the Supreme Court or under Rule 9 of the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure. These conversations are with community-based advocates, and if you look in the bill, on line 4.19, it makes clear that these are community-based advocates. Often they're nonprofits. They're third parties. They're not part of the litigation. And there's also in your packet some information from Violence Free Minnesota and the Minnesota Alliance on Crime that describes the difference between community-based and system-based advocates. And if you look at the boxes there, I think it's the fifth one down, really describes the difference between community-based and system-based. So again, these are not state employees. They are not state actors. It's just like somebody going to their doctor and telling them information that's privileged. We should make sure that we're closing that loophole for domestic violence victims and survivors because they deserve it. Thank you.
All right, we've got a couple public testifiers signed up. First, I have Shauna Kiefer. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Shauna Kiefer. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I was a public defender in Hennepin County for about 10 years. I've been an attorney for 16 years. This bill involves proposed changes that could potentially legislate away a defendant's right to due process in cases involving allegations of domestic abuse. Knowing that this bill touches on domestic violence, I want to acknowledge that my testimony today in no way diminishes this weekend's tragedy in Burnsville. I've handled thousands of cases all over the state in my role as an attorney for the past 16 years. Cases involving allegations of domestic violence are unlike any other when it comes to witness recantations, inconsistent statements, and even at times prosecuting agencies issuing arrest warrants for uncooperative victims. This proposal would further add to these potential manipulations of a domestic victim's statements when they're presented to a domestic violent advocate. There should be a process that allows a judge to conduct an in-camera review to review a domestic advocate's notes as they pertain to statements by an alleged victim of domestic violence. Should this bill pass, a domestic violence advocate or the victim of a domestic violence would have the ability to prevent a defendant from obtaining relevant, material, exculpatory evidence in order to present a full defense. This proposal is ripe for manipulation and could result in wrongful convictions. For example, evidence that would provide for a legitimate claim of self-defense could be withheld if the alleged victim did not consent to disclosing certain pieces of that information. Domestic abuse advocates are not therapists or counselors, and therefore the current statute regarding their opinion or information from or about a victim is different than the provisions for a sexual assault counselor or therapist. The existing statute provides protection unless ordered by the court. The current statute recognizes the differences with such information as it should. This proposal removes even allowing a court in camera with protective orders available from reviewing an advocate's information from or about the alleged victim. And this infringes on the defendant's due process rights, especially the right to confrontation. All statements provided to a domestic violence advocate should be reviewed in camera by a judge pursuant to parity request to determine if any statements are exculpatory and should be disclosed with a protective order to the attorneys in the cases involving allegations of domestic violence. Notice to the alleged victims should be given in accordance with the new rules of criminal procedure. The current statutory provision provides this protection and should not be amended. While we would never want to chill disclosure to domestic abuse advocates, it should not come at the cost of legislating away a defendant's right to due process and their ability to present a full defense.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Guadalupe Lopez. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Bonjour, my name is Guadalupe Lopez. I'm the Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota, the statewide coalition to end relationship abuse. Hello, good morning, Madam Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee. I'm here today to support House File 3509. Our advocates need confidentiality because advocate-client relationship is built on trust and non-judgmental support. I will direct your attention to lines 4.18 to 4.23. You can see that the domestic violence advocate is defined as a person working as an employee or supervised volunteer for a community-based domestic abuse program. It explicitly states that the advocate cannot be an employee of law enforcement, prosecutor's office, or government agency. This difference between community-based systems and systems-based advocates is a common misunderstanding, but we must stress that we are in agreement that the state has legal and moral obligation to disclose all defense favoring evidence that it has. In this case, however, our advocates are not the state. Please see the handout that was sent in for more details on the difference between community-based and systems-based advocacy. The role of our advocates is to provide a critical support to people trying to maintain their safety from domestic violence. Our advocates are connected to victim survivors. We connect them to healthcare, shelter, and other services around the state. They meet with victim survivors at all hours of the day and night in places like hospitals, their home, clinics. They help victim survivors manage their schedules and establish childcare and may help victim survivors navigate complex civil, family, housing, criminal courts, and other systems. In order to do this most effectively, victim survivors need to trust that the things that they are sharing with the advocate will not come back to hurt them. At Violence Free Minnesota, we believe that this bill would actually strengthen protections for criminal defense rather than erode them. This is because domestic violence is underreported and under-prosecuted crime. Many times, victims do not seek assistance from advocates or from the legal system at the first instance of violence in their home. A defendant may currently be facing one count of strangulation, but it is not uncommon for that victim will have disclosed multiple other physical assaults to their advocates. Under this law, these statements would also be confidential. Additionally, the victim survivors themselves are often charged with crimes connected to their victimization. For example, a victim survivor may be drunk when their abuser starts hurting them, and so the victim survivor makes a hard and illegal choice to drive away for safety. Victim survivors may use illegal substances both as coping mechanisms or by force by the abuser. They may commit crimes of survival like shoplifting or writing a bad check, and these are all things which the victim survivor may disclose to their advocates for survival. So their advocate can get a full picture of what their life is like. These are all the things that could happen to be criminally charged for if the prosecutor can subpoena their records and discover the admissions. We fully support this bill, and we fully support strengthening the relationship between advocates and their clients through the legal guarantee of confidentiality. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Waller, you said you've been working on this for a decade. Why has it taken so long? Is it because of the pushback about possible exculpatory evidence? What's the rub there?
Yeah.
Chair Mueller.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Lead Scott, thank you for the question. Because the courts for decades have been saying that they can do an in-camera review, so a defense attorney may say, oh, I think this victim is getting mental health records, I would like the, or mental health treatment, or seeing an advocate, I would like the court to do an in-camera review and let us know if there's anything in that information that's exculpatory and turn it over. And courts had traditionally been conducting that in-camera review. And the Minnesota Supreme Court in the 2022 decision that I mentioned, the Hope Coalition case, said a privilege is a privilege, and that is not, we shouldn't be just doing these in-camera reviews anymore. The due process rights that somebody has is against the state actor. These are third parties. And I think some of the sort of tradition of granting these in sexual assault and domestic violence cases has to do from the myth that these victims shouldn't be believed. I really think that stems from that sort of belief that victims of these crimes shouldn't be believed, and therefore we should comb through all of these privileged records and find out if they made that one statement that should be disclosed to the defense.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mueller, so walk me through a scenario where an alleged victim tells their advocate that maybe some exculpatory evidence, such as, you know, I've dealt a lot with family law in my time down here, and I know the power of a false accusation in family law court. So if the victim says, you know, I'm doing this because I want custody of the kids, and this will be one way of getting this on the record, whatever, so to speak. And then the victim doesn't disclose that to the prosecutor, or doesn't disclose that in some way, and that's sort of exculpatory evidence. What happens? That just nothing is actionable there?
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, these are privileged communications, just like an attorney-client privilege would have. And that Hope Coalition case that I mentioned in 2022, the Minnesota Supreme Court talked about that. I don't know if any advocates that are here or Director Lopez wants to speak to that, about if victims say exculpatory things like that to their advocates, but the bottom line is those are privileged communications with a third party who's not a state. Now, I think there's still some situation where there would be obviously constitutional rights and due process concerns trump anything else. And the Hope Coalition case talked about that. In that particular case, there wasn't a due process violation. So I think the courts have left open some narrow situation where there could be a situation like that. But really the bottom line is those are privileged, just like attorney-client communications.
Okay, thank you. Representative Scott.
Okay.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And my question will be for Ms. Kiefer from MacDill, if she wants to make her way down. Chair Mueller, thank you for bringing this bill forward. In my experience as a deputy, this reminds me of showing up at someone's home where a woman was unfortunately abused from head to toe, and there was no sexual assault involved. But clearly this was something that had been ongoing, you know, just an awful thing for somebody to have to relive and talk about. And I mean, at the end of our interaction, all she really wanted was a hug and to know that someone would be brought to justice and that she would be safe. And all of this happened in front of her children. And so, you know, I say this because, you know, we're talking about very serious situations, very traumatic situations. So my question for MacDill is, why does MacDill believe that domestic violence survivors deserve less protections than other privilege holders like survivors of sexual assault?
Ms. Kiefer.
Thank you. I have to remember how to do this formally. Chair Becker Finn. And as to your question, Member Curran, we don't believe that. We believe all defendants deserve a fair right to trial and that they're presumed innocent unless and until they're shown guilty. I'm so sorry that you had that personal lived experience, and I'm so sorry that so many women do. But this isn't about that. This is about as a public defender, I had a victim that recorded their conversation with the advocate saying, I don't want to go forward with this case. And the prosecutor was representing to me that the advocate said that they did want to go forward and that the evidence matched that case. Because that victim had recorded this statement and sent it to me randomly, I could show that prosecutor that the victim advocate was misrepresenting what this person said. But if we take away the right to confrontation, which is one of our fundamental rights, it's what this country was established on, was that we're going to start off believing that you are innocent unless and until you are proven guilty. And so, no, I absolutely believe with all my heart that people that commit serious crimes should face the consequences for it. And I do believe that many women are diminished and not given their voice, and I certainly would never want to do anything to take away from that. But I do think that there should be a mechanism whereby a judge can review what a victim advocate is saying to see whether or not they're representing what that person has said. Another contention that I had with Ms. Moeller's representation about the advocates not working for the prosecutor. They come to court, they quite often, in the cases that I've had, sit down with the prosecutor to gather their statements together, not always, but quite often. And so while we have these huge protections, which hopefully would somehow someone would know that these rights to Brady and the rights under Rule 9 had been violated and upheld, there's really no way to do that unless the judge is able to determine that. But no, I don't want to silence any voices, but I also don't want any people wrongfully convicted or any defendants treated lesser just because the nature of what they're accused is so gross that we decide we're not going to give them a fair shot.
So a couple things. You might want to be careful in characterizing what Chair Moeller has said as a misrepresentation. Those advocates don't necessarily work for the state, so you might want to be careful.
Not all of them. I'm sorry if I said that. You just did.
So I'm going to correct that because that's not how you're going to speak to Chair Moeller, because that just isn't true. That advocates, just because the advocate is there with the victim and the prosecutor also wants to speak with the victim, doesn't mean that they work for the state. They are separate. And we do have a handout here on the difference between community-based advocates and system-based advocates, and I'd encourage you to take a copy of that when you leave today. I also will just speak as someone who was also a domestic violence prosecutor, and I, the role that I played was that I was one of the kind of the closest to sort of a boots on the ground prosecutor working in the Domestic Abuse Service Center, where I literally worked side by side and daily with community advocates and spoke directly and listened directly to victims. I was one of the few prosecutors in the office where a victim or a person could call directly and speak to an attorney. And so I just want to correct, you know, something that was in this letter and the conversations that have been happening around this issue, that a victim survivor has the right to change their mind. They may at one point not want to go forward, and later on circumstances could change and they want to go forward. Was very common on the cases I worked on, was that a person may initially, right after that extreme violence has happened, they do want the case to go forward because they want to disrupt the violence. And then as time goes forward, maybe they've got 3 kids with that person and that person's income was helping them to keep their housing. And we need to trust victim survivors to know best how to keep themselves and their children alive. And so a victim has the choice. It is always their choice. And their decision can change as the process goes forward. So just because someone decides later on, 3 months later, it is no longer in the best interest of keeping me and my family safe, that I'm going to no longer participate in the prosecution, doesn't mean that they were lying. It does not mean that they were lying. It means they are making the choice that they need to make to stay alive. And we all need to trust that they know better than any of us, than law enforcement, then prosecutors, then anybody in this room, how to stay alive, because they're the only ones who know their situation. So I just want us to be really careful with all this, using the word allegedly and recantate. Like, there are many reasons why a person may change their mind about how something might move forward. And I understand it's really complicated and not everyone has the lived experience every day of working around domestic violence, but I just want us to be really careful in assigning motives for why a person may or may not continue with the prosecution process. Representative Curran, you have the floor.
Thank you, Chair. And I don't have any other questions, but just sort of in response to the answer, I simply disagree. I find the opinion of MacDill quite appalling, to be completely frank with you. And you know, my question was if domestic violence survivors deserve less protections than sexual assault survivors. And the answer I received was that defendants have constitutional rights. I am not disagreeing about constitutional rights. I think those are, they are in place. I think those are protected. I think the right to a fair trial and, you know, all of the access that defendants have for a fair case, I think that stands even with this bill moving forward. I don't see this as a bill to protect defendants. I see this as a bill to protect the private information of people who have been through trauma. And that is the reason why I strongly support it. And again, I think, I just thank you, Chair Becker Finn, for your comments on that as well. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Moeller, thank you. Chair Becker Finn, thank you for your comments. These advocates are there not for the courts, not for the prosecutors. They're there for the victims. Many times, in my 27 plus years in law enforcement, I don't know how many thousands of domestics I've been at. And generally, there's one theme. The perpetrator is doing this for control and by intimidation. And these victims, they've lived a long life of it, unfortunately. And they finally got to the point where they called for help. And that call for help is usually with law enforcement because of a very traumatic situation. Now, law enforcement has worked for years getting very highly trained advocates that help those victims. They don't help with the prosecution other than talking to the victim and getting them through having to live that event again in court. But they provide the services needed to help them live with it, help them get through it so they can have a better life and a safer life for them and a lot of times for their kids. Representative Moeller, thank you for bringing this forward. These advocates are no different than what these victims say if they go confess to their priest, which is also protected. So these advocates are the angels in the system helping the victims. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Johnson. I often think of advocates prevent more homicides than I think anyone else in the system because they work so closely to the details to know exactly what victims need in these situations. So Representative Moeller, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yeah, just really would encourage anyone opposed to read the Hope Coalition case from 2022 because this isn't about the right of confrontation, cross-examining witnesses. This really isn't due process because that's a right a defendant has against the state. Again, these are third party. And just to emphasize what Director Lopez said here, that this applies universally. So sometimes prosecutors try to get privileged information in like child protection in cases, and they're denied as well, and they should be denied. This is really about protecting those communications that are so important for survival. Domestic violence victims, survivors, deserve no less protections than anyone else, and I look forward to your vote. Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you. Chair Moeller renews her motion that House File 3509 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Moeller. We're going to switch the order around a little bit since we're running behind. Representative Feist, would you like to move that House File 3483 be referred to the Human Services Policy Committee? I'm going to assume you heard me while you were walking up there.
Heard you.
Great.
Yeah, go, right?
All right, is that your motion?
I actually didn't hear you, but I trust you. So yes, that is my motion.
You just moved that House File 3483 be referred to Human Services Policy.
Yes.
Okay, great. And then I understand you have a technical amendment, the A1 amendment, that just gets the bill in the shape that it needs to be in. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
All right. Representative Feist moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is approved. Give me an hour. Representative Feist, to your bill as amended.
Yep. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So the heart of House File 3483 is to protect the rights of the 35,000 Minnesotans who are subject to guardianship, who are among the most vulnerable people in our state. The bill language corrects confusing statutory language related to immunity for guardians, created by a 2022 Minnesota Court of Appeals case that held that a guardian receives blanket immunity, full immunity, for any acts of negligence. The statute, subject to interpretation, lays out the main powers and duties a guardian has for the provision of care, maintenance, and support. With blanket immunity under these broad powers and duties, a guardian could provide no food, no water, no care, and even neglect the person subject to the guardianship, leading to death, and not be liable. Most states have little or no immunity for guardians. Minnesota is believed to be the only state to take such a position of blanket immunity for guardians. This is different from qualified immunity. As described in the attached memo provided by Advocates for Guardians, it provides examples of how states have done what we propose and create liability in certain circumstances involving particularly harmful behavior and intent. Minnesota does not have a history of bringing liability claims against guardians for their care functions. And the 2022 case was actually the first time that Minnesota courts had interpreted this statute since it was enacted in 1981. This means that guardians and attorneys have operated for many decades under the assumption of some liability for reckless or illegal behavior in their role as guardians. There's no reason to expect a flurry of new cases, especially when the recourse for misbehavior of a guardian is typically simply removing that guardian. The need to correct this language is urgent, given this outlier position created by the 2022 case and the risk of harm and stripping of rights of people subject to guardianship. In your materials, you will find numerous letters detailing guardian abuse, neglect, disregard for medical needs and safeguards, and willful and cruel refusal to share information with family members that would have benefited the well-being of the person under their care. To address concerns that have been raised regarding ensuring a sustained number of qualified, willing guardians, this bill is drafted to make it harder to prevail on a claim of liability against a guardian. In addition, this bill creates a task force to be convened by the Minnesota Council on Disability that is going to identify gaps and problems in the current system and to report on solutions. Note that no party has provided any concrete proposals for modifying this language, but a good faith effort has been made through many, many, many meetings with many people, many stakeholders, to encompass these concerns within the bill language. Unfortunately, Mr. Zika, who provided a letter, and his nephew, I believe it is, also provided a letter. He was not able to make it this morning. And also, unfortunately, people who are under guardianship, they have limited mobility, and it was difficult for any of them to be with us. But your materials have a lot of really powerful statements that I encourage you to read, describing what this bill seeks to address. And with that, I will turn it over to the experts.
All right. First on the list, I have Director Chris Sundberg. Please introduce yourself.
Yep, members of the committee. I'm Chris Sundberg. I'm Executive Director of Elder Voice Advocates, and we advocate for quality care and protection of rights for both elders and people with disabilities. With me today is Suzanne Scheller. She is our legal advisor and is expert in this particular area. I'll turn it over to you, Suzanne.
Thank you so much. I am Suzanne Scheller. I'm an attorney and the legal advisor for Elder Voice Advocates. House File 3483 seeks to balance the rights of the 35,000 persons under guardianship with the important role of the guardian. In the Zika v. Weaver case, the court interpreted complete immunity for guardians. Complete immunity is generally not the answer to protecting individuals. Under complete immunity, a person cannot be found liable, and the case is not heard on the merits, as in the Zika case. under qualified immunity, a person is immune from liability except under certain circumstances, which are proposed in this bill. In Minnesota, government officials, municipalities, even Good Samaritans, for instance, receive qualified immunity. The proposed language raises the bar from a reasonable to a more restrictive intentional standard, trying to balance those interests. Based on that state-by-state research, Minnesota is believed to be the only state with that complete immunity. A minority of states have qualified immunity. Iowa, for instance, on which some of the current language was based, grants immunity to guardians except for breach of fiduciary duty concepts and willful or wanton misconduct. Guardians in Minnesota have always been immune from third-party acts. Guardians in other states have been able to find a way to function with qualified immunity, and even some states no immunity. We have faith that guardians will continue to serve well here, while still addressing issues such as funding and alternatives in the proposed guardianship task force. Approximately 3,000 new guardianships are added each year, one-third of those being for those age 65 plus, approximately one-third of those having a professional guardian. Elder Voice Advocates sought out stakeholders and invited them to the table to discuss this important legislation. We have worked hard to listen to the concerns of professional guardians and others to balance competing interests. The bill represents a viable compromise. Why would we afford less rights and protections in this arena to those under guardianship versus our other Minnesotans? We ask you to vote yes on House File 3483. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next up, signed up ahead of time, I have Robert McLeod.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. My name is Robert McLeod. If for some of you have been around here a long time, about 22 years ago, I was here when we completely rewrote the guardianship statutes, and I rewrote all of those. I wrote the book, I wrote the court forms, I wrote the court manual, and I've been a part of every major legislation since then. We have tried to work with the group that wants to make these changes to the statute. So I was very surprised to hear that alternatives were not offered. We begged for a committee to sit down and just pause for a second and let's go back and rewrite this together. Let's try to find a way to make this work without the unintended consequences that are already taking place. That didn't happen. Alternatives were offered. It didn't happen. So it's kind of frustrating to hear that when we work so hard. A lot of the issues that happened in the Zika case were adjusted, or at this point in the 2020 legislation, by statute, they would have had to have been reported, but they didn't have to be reported back then. These continual words, I use blanket immunity. The Zika case applies to 524.5-313C2. Doesn't apply to C1 or C3 or C4 subdivision 1, subdivision 2, 3, or 4. Doesn't apply to C5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10. There is not blanket immunity, but there is a big umbrella there of care and support under C2. That's absolutely true. But the simple truth is, and I do have materials for you, and on page 2, paragraph 1, where I say, let's start with the obvious, where it says, the great compromise was simple in this state. Guardians will not be paid in Minnesota, but they are found liable in limited circumstances. Absolutely true. The compromise allowed Minnesota to receive the benefit of guardians for its citizens at limited cost. In exchange, the guardians did not have to fear excessive liability. That's been the detente for 40 years. We don't pay guardians. Guardians are not making a fortune being a guardian. There's no insurance to back up a guardian. This idea of, oh, well, we'll just sue the insurance company and then we'll recover money. It's not there. The insurance isn't there. And what has already started is people are refusing to become guardians now. I represent people who are trying to avoid being under guardianship. I represent people who are under guardianship. I represent individual guardians. I represent professional guardians. Professional guardians have already said we're not taking them anymore.
And Mr. McLeod, I'll just remind you, we do have your written materials are included in the packet, so you don't need to read things to us that are also in the packet, if you could wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The quick point is everyone, every stakeholder in this area wants to work out something reasonable to get to a good solution that doesn't change guardianship law in Minnesota to the point that we can't find guardians. But let us sit down and do that. But if this gets jammed through, there's a complete liability, and those of you who are already in place, you can't get out. You're stuck. This is creating a horrific chilling effect already. And I'm begging you to ask the authors of the bill to fall back and sit down with the stakeholders. And we've had multiple Zoom meetings where we've requested this. Sit down with the stakeholders and allow us to work on legislation that will work for everybody, that doesn't keep people from saying, I'm not going to be a guardian, but addresses the legitimate concern of, are you telling me there's no liability? Everyone gets that. But allow us to balance these without the legislation passing through as it is. That's my request.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Come on up. And if there's anybody else wishing to testify, if you could come have a seat up here so we could keep things moving along, that would be helpful. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Becker Finn, Representative Feist, and committee members. My name is Jill Sauber. I am a certified elder law attorney. I'm certified by the National Elder Law Foundation, accredited by the American Bar Association. I also happen to be a commissioner with the ABA Commission on Law and Aging and a practicing attorney here in Minnesota. I'm here today in opposition to House File 3483. I will keep this very brief because we do have Robert McLeod's very good materials. I will just highlight a couple of things. The Zika case that is kind of the reason for this proposed legislation specifically states in the decision that no blanket immunity was granted, not by the Minnesota Statute 524-313C2 or by the decision itself. The decision held that the plain language in that case does not grant blanket immunity, and it only applies to C2, that provision itself. There's already a chilling effect, as Mr. McLeod said. It's very difficult to find guardians to take on these cases, especially in cases where it's an indigent person who might be qualified for informa pauperis, or IFP, where they maybe have a waiver of their fees and costs. How is that guardian going to be paid? We have to rely on either persons who are interested, related to that person or friends, to step forward and take on the role. Or we rely on professional guardians, especially in those instances where family members might be fighting and they can't agree on who might take on the role. I'm in a unique position where I represent a lot of family members who might be interested in filing for guardianship. I will tell the committee that there's a very big movement towards supported decision making, the lesser restrictive alternatives that we enacted here by statute in 2020, and self-determination. In my practice, I promote self-determination. That is the movement nationally. We want to allow people, even if they are subject to guardianship, to be subject to only a limited guardianship insofar as they are able to make their own decisions. There's a movement away from a plenary or general guardianship, and we want people to be able to make their own decisions. This proposed legislation, we have to balance that self-determination with guardian liability. And it's difficult because every case is so different. I fear that the chilling effect that's already happening just with this proposed legislation is going to increase, especially if this passes. it's extremely difficult to find not only private guardians, family members, or friends that are willing to take on this kind of thankless job, honestly, in a lot of cases, but it's absolutely way more difficult to find private, neutral, professional guardians to take on this role. I'm already finding that. I am all about self-determination, and in my cases, when I bring a petition for guardianship, I'm always doing it in the most limited way. I don't want to take away the rights of the person. I want them to be able to make all the decisions that they're able to. But even in those cases, with a limited guardianship, where we're only asking for some of the powers under the statute to apply, it's still very difficult to find professionals to step forward. I've been denied. I have a case right now. It's an emergency matter. I have a person, you know, my client's brother, who is, he has some mental health issues. He has some substance abuse issues. The sibling is actually a practicing attorney in another state, so she's not local, not willing to take it on, cannot take it on. And I've called around to my network to find a professional guardian. I cannot find one because they are all waiting to see what happens here today.
Yep, and if I could ask you to wrap up, I understand, too, like just for the record, that conversations about this issue and this bill went on over quite a bit, few months over the summer, and it does have multiple committee stops. So there will be definitely opportunities for further conversation. So
I appreciate the time today, and I just want to say that I don't believe that this bill is a viable compromise. I do oppose the bill, and I do appreciate your time.
All right, thank you. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Nis- oh, sorry. Yep. And if there's anybody else from the public wishing to testify, I'm not going to say it again. If you could come up here so I know that you're waiting to speak so we don't run out of time.
I understand the last person's concern about guardianship.
Yep. And if you could, can you introduce yourself?
I'm James Zika. I was one involved in that law. It was listed in the lawsuit that's being argued. And I feel sorry for the people who are able to deal for themselves in a guardianship arrangement. If my sister had dementia and was unable to deal for herself, I will read you the letter I wrote to your committee.
And actually, we can read. All right. So that's part of the reason we have copies. But if you could summarize
the guardian,
it, of course.
The guardian we had totally disregarded what was best for my sister. She failed to provide. My sister had dementia. There were memory care, skilled nursing facilities available in the Brainerd Lakes area that she could have been put in. But when we asked for that, she refused, just absolutely refused to even try. When my sister was sexually assaulted in the facility, she coerced the management to not tell us. So my sister was never given proper assistance for her trauma, and we did not even know about it until a court case appeared, which she also tried to keep the prosecuting attorney in the county from contacting us about. And that's when we discovered that my sister had been sexually assaulted, and her decline followed immediately after that, we now understand, because we couldn't understand why all of a sudden she went from being fairly stable to just straight downhill and dying in September, a few months later. Yes, there are many good guardians out there, or people who are trying their best, but there are also some guardians out there that aren't good, and people who are incapable of taking care of themselves. There's a need to have some kind of protection for those people as well. And the idea that you can be held liable, maybe the liability needs to be restricted, but the liability, if she had thought she could be held liable for what she did, we might have been able to get her to do some things to respond that would have made my sister's care better. But instead, she just dug in, refused to do anything, and you know, my sister was, I was very close to my sister when I was growing up. I had a lot of business activities in the last few years. So but you always think next year we'll get things back together again, and you don't realize where things are going. But this guardian was not performing her duties, and there was nothing we could do to pressure her to do her duties. She would just simply say to us, I can do whatever I want to, whenever we'd ask her to do something for the benefit of my sister. I feel sorry for the people who are professionals. Yes, maybe they need a clear thing, but people who are vulnerable adults, and I worked as a nurse for 30 years, and I also have a master's degree in public health administration, so I worked in healthcare in and out for 30 years at every level, even started out as a combat medic, so I know healthcare from every level.
You can't have
vulnerable adults taken care of by people and have them have no liability for what they do to people. So
I know it's an emotional issue, and there are letters in our packets, I think, from other people who've had firsthand experience. So I encourage members to take a look at those letters. But I do want to wrap us up so we can actually get to member discussion.
It was clear to me for a long time that something needs to be done to improve this situation where a guardian can just provide no proper care for an individual who is not able to defend themselves in any way whatsoever, as like dementia patients.
Yeah. And thank you for your testimony, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you so
much. All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker Fan, and a question that I wanted one of the two attorneys who testified in opposition to talk about, and maybe we don't have time to do that today. I don't know, but I'm very sympathetic, sort of thematically, to the concern. But it sounded like, I guess what I didn't hear from either of the testifiers in opposition was responsive to the language that's in this bill. And I would be very, very sympathetic, especially to the concern if we were just deleting the sentence from C2 and not, I think, fairly carefully, and I hope carefully enough, crafting a qualified immunity provision. And I understand this has future committee stops. I would invite either of them to set up a meeting with me. I would love to hear some further discussion responsive to the actual standard that is written in this. It's not just a negligence standard. If it was just a negligence standard, I think I heard some pretty powerful arguments as to why this would be a bad or a problem, or at least a more concerning bill. I didn't hear today anyway anything responsive to the actual language on page 5 that we're writing into it. So I'm not sure where I am at on this bill. I certainly am concerned about putting volunteers in a position where they have to defend against litigation without some sort of backstop to support them in that. But I appreciate the work that's been done to try to make sure that that's very narrowly tailored and bringing in qualified immunity concepts. So that's my comment, I guess, for today to either of the and my invitation to either of those, Mr. McLeod, and I'm sorry I missed the other testifier's name, but that's my comment for today.
Yeah, Representative Feist, any comment to that?
I just think that would be wonderful. I'd love to work with you, Representative Niska, and the folks who have concerns, if they would like to come forward with some real specific, concrete proposals on what we can do with this language. I would love to also connect with them, so I'd love to work together on this.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And I was just going to add on to that, Representative Feist, you're known around here for working on situations, I guess, bills like this in a way that you can find some peace in the valley. And it just seems like, you know, I came in here ready to vote for this bill, and then there are concerns, and I think they're valid concerns to take into consideration. And so I just encourage you to continue doing what you've done in the past on a lot of bills, and that's you do some hard work. I mean, I think of the student data privacy and how much you worked on that. And so this is a really important issue, and people's lives are at stake. So I would hope, yeah, you just continue on that. And Madam Chair, if the liability pieces change, I would hope that this committee would have a chance to look at that change if it's changed in some other committee. But those are my comments. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you so much for the great discussion today. Just to summarize, like, this bill is urgent. It's addressing a really important gap in protections for the most vulnerable Minnesotans. There are many other states that have some type of limited liability, such as the liability that we're proposing here. And in those states, they continue to have a supply of willing, qualified guardians. And so there's no reason to believe that the sky will fall if we create similar liability. And in fact, over the last many decades since the statute was first written, there was an assumption that there was some level of liability. And I think the last point I'll make is that there's no reason to expect this cascade of litigation. This is a statute that has not been litigated almost at all since 1981. And so I am really excited to hear that Representative Niska's interested in getting involved and digging into the details, and looking forward to talking with people who have concerns with their very concrete proposals for what we can do with this specific language. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 3483 as amended be referred to the Human Services Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Feist. Obviously, we've got not that much time left on the schedule, so the Representative Egbadje bill will just reschedule to a different date. We're going to move to the Representative Finke bill. Representative Feist. Representative Feist, if I could get you. Yeah. Yeah. She'll come to you, sir.
Thank you. Yeah. I agree with you.
Representative Feist, my clock is ticking. If you can stand up and move.
Taking the podium here.
Oh, I'm not. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted me to do my Todd bill.
No.
Oh, sorry.
I was like, usually you're so responsive. Sorry, MSBA. We might have to kick you to another day, but we've got House File 3607. Representative Finke. I will move House File 3607 before the committee. We're going to be laying this bill over, but I did want to get the discussion going today and walk through. Do we want to go through, do we want to do the A1 amendment first, Representative Finke?
Yes,
all right. So the A1 amendment, do you want to tell us a little bit about what the A1 does? Representative Finke will move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. The A1 amendment is drafted to reflect concerns of Teamsters Local 320. The A1 amendment, in short, reinstates language that is stricken from HF 3607. It amends the provisions that affect the state public defender. It reinstates a four-year term length. It reinstates a stricken process for removal and the July 1 start date for term.
All right. Any discussion to the A1? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Finke, tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. It's a great pleasure to be here carrying this bill. I thank the chair for entrusting me with this bill. I look forward to carrying it into the future. And in the interest of time, I will pass it over to my testifiers to walk us through the bill.
Mr. Kyer, please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members, Kevin Kyer, Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. I know you all are pressed for time, so I'm going to go through this rather quickly. There are a number of provisions in this bill that deal with transition from a county-based public defender system to a state-based public defender system. There are a number of provisions in here that are, in some respects, 30 and 40 years old. There are really four main policy areas or policy changes, if you will, that are not kind of housekeeping. The first one is a proposal in the bill to eliminate the $75 public defender copayment. Copayments originally were put in and established when we had a county-based public defender system. Those copayments went to the individual county to offset their costs for public defender services. Over time, that copayment was then changed. When we had a state public defender system, or started a statewide public defender system, during a budget crisis in 2003, The legislature funded the second year of the biennium for public defense using non-waivable public defender co-payments, some of which were as high as $750. That co-payment was found unconstitutional because there was not a waiver provision. The legislature came back, reestablished a waivable co-payment that I believe it was $25 at the time, might have been $28. During a subsequent budget crisis, it was then waived, I should say the co-payment was increased again to the current $75. Those funds raised go to the general fund. Raises about $1.1 million a year for the general fund. We're asking in this bill to have that co-payment eliminated. We understand that creates a hole in the general fund. We've presented this piece to the governor's office about a supplemental, in his supplemental budget. Obviously, that'll be next week when we hear about that. The second piece, Representative Finke referred to the term of the state public defender. We also have terms for chief public defenders. They're 4-year terms and can only be removed for cause. Again, this dates back to when we had a county-based system where the local judge actually appointed the chief public defender and they recommended who the assistant public defenders were. Those were all part-time public defenders at the time. So you can imagine the conflict that created in terms of your local public defender system. So we are asking, the board is asking to have that move to a system where those chief public defenders are at will, but it would take a 2/3 vote of the board to remove them. I will tell you that all of these provisions in this bill, save one, were unanimously approved by our board and our chief public defenders. The third piece of a policy change is the public defender reimbursements. Again, this goes back to 40 years ago, again, where we had a county-based system. In 1993, it was changed where the public defender reimbursements from clients that can be ordered to pay, again, it's not everywhere, but it can be paid, is then stays within a judicial district and is allocated to the part-time public defenders to help offset their overcost. Well, this was established when about 70% of our public defenders were part-time. We're now down to about 32 or 33% of the public defenders are part-time. Like the co-payment, this is unevenly applied. If you are in Hennepin or Ramsey County, you've never heard of this. This doesn't happen. The co-payment also is routinely waived. If you go down to the 5th Judicial District, you have public defenders who may be getting as much as $14,000 or $15,000 a year in these reimbursements. The identical size district, the 6th Judicial District, the Arrowhead, they might get $40. So we're proposing in this bill, or the board is proposing, the elimination of that reimbursement and an appropriation to make up that funding to then spread that amount equally among all of the part-time public defenders to defray their overhead. Finally, Madam Chair, and I know you're pressed for time, there is
they gave us a couple extra minutes, but that doesn't mean you should slow down.
I'm not. I've been here before, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kyle.
The last piece, I had mentioned this is not a board position, but the attorneys that do this work asked us to include this in the bill, is on pretrial appeals. Right now, if there's a pretrial motion that a prosecutor loses, bringing in a witness, bringing in some evidence, they can appeal that decision of the district court judge to the Court of Appeals. The prosecuting county pays for that, and that has been a longstanding provision, I should say. In 2012, there were some concern because what had happened was there were a couple of private cases that came through that were big cases and were charging, those private attorneys were charging their private rate on those appeals. And they were pretty extensive appeals. We got together with the County Attorneys Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and put together what you see, the language that you see in the bill, which is There is a review of the appointed counsel rates by that the counties now use. That they then establish that rate, and there's a $5,000 cap or a threshold. If an attorney is going to go over that amount, they have to go back to the chief judge to get permission to do that. Well, that was down back in 2012. They're asking that that move be moved from $5,000 to $10,000. Again, a significant number of these are private cases. Some of them are public defender cases. Some of them, frankly, are private attorneys that don't have any appellate experience, and they bring them to us that we then farm out. So a lot of these cases are not public defender eligible cases. So I know that's really quick, Madam Chair. I know there's more in it, but I know you're pressed for time, so I will obviously stand for any questions the committee might have.
Yep, and again, we'll be laying this over. You know, there's some financial implications within this bill, so there'll be time for more discussion, but did want to make sure in case there was anyone here to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? And I will say the amendment was also something I was interested in. I know we talked about the bill overall over the last couple of months, but just, you know, in full disclosure, that was something I was interested in addressing as well. Not seeing anyone here to testify. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this bill. And I did talk to Mr. Kier, I don't even remember what day it was, recently, about the pretrial appeal raising the cost. So just so people understand how the process works, if the prosecutor loses a motion, say, below, the only way they can appeal pretrial is if they can show critical impact to the case. So it is a very narrow window of cases that the prosecutor can even get before an appellate court, ever, frankly. And so they're not done very often. And one of the factors that goes into deciding whether or not to bring a pretrial appeal is the cost that the county will incur. Because win or lose, if the district court judge made a horrible decision that has critical impact on the case, we appeal it to the Court of Appeals and we win, the county still has to pay that amount. And so just I wanted to make sure people understand how that works. I understand the need to raise this since it's been so many years since that limit was set. I will note that the current language of the statute says that they can go to the chief judge to provide fair compensation above that $5,000. So I'm a little concerned about the $10,000 in light of the fact that, again, win or lose, the county is going to have to pay that and may decide not to take a really good case up because of that cost. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I think conversations can be ongoing on where that line needs to be, but I think addressing some of these long-term sort of structural things that we're now in a place where hopefully we can disentangle some things that really should be disentangled is a good deal. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And I'm just wondering if the bill's author or the testifier could explain the change back to the 4 years in the amendment for the chief defender, but not for the chief appellate defender.
Whoever wants to take that. I think like some of it is just understanding the difference between a local chief public defender and the state public defender, but Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Scott. I believe that that's essentially the case. We haven't really had a problem with the current system, so changing it doesn't really make sense. And I personally like the idea of having people have to run again for the offices that they maintain. So if we'd like to go further, we have lots more time to talk about this bill. So there is somebody from Teamsters who can talk about the in more detail if you'd like, but I leave that to the chair in terms of our time frame.
Yeah, we can take a quick but yeah, I think the amendment, just to clarify for anyone still listening to this very lawyery committee today, is about the state public defender and not necessarily the chief public defender. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Edward Reynoso. I'm the Director of Political and Legislative Affairs for Local 320. Quite frankly, we're not opposed to changing both segments of it, and mostly just to answer a little more, it's about transparency and accountability. And we believe it's critically important that such an important position as the state public defender should be up for reevaluation every 4 years. And on top of that, have an opportunity to possibly replace if necessary.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Reynoso, I've been down here a long time. You've been down here a long time. We don't agree on much, but I agree with you. So thank you for your explanation.
Yeah, thank you. And I agree as well. So there we go.
Everybody agrees today.
Yeah, everybody's happy today. Great. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn. Mr. Wharton, the question I have is on the reimbursement, or the $75. A couple different questions. I'll do a little.
I've got 5 minutes before I have to gavel us out. So
I'll do both of them real quick. One is how many dollars is that going to affect your budget? And two, with that $75, I know there's many individuals that are appointed a public defender that actually do not qualify. What is the process for recouping the total cost for what the public defender's office did to people that don't qualify?
Mr. Kyler. Yeah.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, there's two things. One is the $75 copayment. The other one is on the reimbursement. What we have found is the judges do a pretty good job of eligibility screening. What we have found is the reimbursement statute as it is tends to encourage the appointment of folks who may not qualify. And then what ends up happening is they're ordered to reimburse, and the reimbursement obviously never matches what the cost of providing the service is, right? So that was part of it as well. The total for reimbursements, it's been amazingly consistent. It ranges from about $380,000 a year. I think last year was $338,000. We shot for the middle in terms of the governor's supplemental budget to say $350,000, again, to spread that among all of the part-timers equitably. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yep. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Mr. Ward, I'm just wondering how does the state recoup the money that they spend to a person that did not qualify? Not just the $75, the whole cost, because if those didn't qualify, we shouldn't be paying for any of their costs.
Mr. Kyle.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I would agree. I would think our position is they shouldn't be appointed in the first place.
Fair enough. Not seeing any further people on the list. Representative Finke, closing comments before we lay this over.
No.
All right. And as obviously we're talking about money, there's some financial things. So I will lay this over, and I'm sure that we can fine tune some details if needed once we have a target and have some idea of what we're working with. So with that, I will lay House File 3607 as amended, will be laid over. And with that, we are adjourned.